The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a huge subject, 19th century Britain. We're looking at that incredibly packed period, roughly from the French Revolution's fallout around 1789, right up to the brink of World War I in 1914.
And it's just such a pivotal era, isn't it? This wasn't simply another century passing. It's where, arguably, the modern world was forged. Industrial capitalism, sprawling cities, the beginnings of mass democracy.
Yeah.
It all kind of explodes here.
Absolutely. And we're navigating this with the help of two fantastic historians, Christopher Harvey and H.E.G. Matthew, whose work really synthesizes this complex time.
Right. And the big question for you listening is probably this. How on earth did Britain, this relatively small island, become the first global industrial superpower? And even more intriguingly, how did it manage all that change, that upheaval, without the kind of political revolutions we saw constantly erupting across Europe?
That's the core puzzle, isn't it? You look at France, Germany, Italy, constant turmoil. Yet Britain somehow holds on to its older structures, its parliament, its monarchy.
But as we'll explore in this deep dive, Harvey and Matthew show that stability wasn't, you know, the default setting. It wasn't inevitable.
No, it was something constantly fought for, right? A really precarious balancing act achieved over what they call a chasm of social conflict.
Exactly. It was all about navigating this tension between tradition and, well, this relentless drive towards modernity. It created a blueprint in many ways that other nations ended up following.
So let's talk about the guides for this journey. H.E.G. Matthew. He's the political heavyweight, isn't he?
He really is. Deeply immersed in high politics. Famously edited the massive Gladstone Diaries, so he understood the inner workings of Westminster, the evolution of British liberalism, like few others. He knew how the decisions were made at the top.
Okay, so he brings that insider political perspective, but then you've got Christopher Harvey.
Right, and Harvey provides the perfect counterpoint. He's more focused on the social and cultural side of things. He looked at the regions, Scotland especially, radical movements, literature. Essentially, he gave voice to those outside the immediate circles of power, the ruled, not just the rulers.
So it's this combination, this synergy that makes their work so powerful. It's not just kings and prime ministers.
Not at all. They connect the dots. They show how a policy debated in London directly impacted, say, mill workers in Manchester or miners in Wales. You get the whole picture.
You really need both sides, don't you? The state's power and the immense social change happening everywhere else.
Precisely. You can't understand one without the other. That's their central argument, really.
Okay, let's dive into the book's main argument then. What's the core premise Harvey and Matthew lay out?
Well, first off, they completely reject any neat story of, you know, smooth, inevitable progress towards modernity. Forget that.
Right, they paint a much messier picture, more dynamic, more contested.
Absolutely. They see the 19th century as incredibly precarious. Britain was often seemingly just one crisis away from boiling over. Stability had to be actively managed, constantly renegotiated.
And they break this down thematically, looking at these huge shifts happening all at once.
Yeah, exactly. They track four main transformations running in parallel. First, the massive economic leap from fields to factories, basically, becoming the world's industrial powerhouse.
Then the political evolution from aristocracy towards, well, towards something resembling mass democracy, even if it took a long time.
Mm-hmm. Third, the social upheaval people flooding into cities, the creation of really distinct class identities, which became so defining.
And fourth, you can't ignore the empire, can you? Its massive expansion shaped everything back home.
Absolutely central. But what I think is really compelling is their focus on the people caught up in all this. How did ordinary folk adapt? How did factory workers or the new middle class or even the old landed gentry make sense of it all?
How did they fit their old beliefs, their communities, into this new world of machines and cities?
Right. And that leads back to the paradox we started with. The very things making Britain incredibly powerful, the industry, the free market ideas, were also causing enormous suffering and instability. Think Peterloo. Think Chartism.
Think the Irish famine.
Exactly. It was this constant cycle. Industrial change creates social crisis, and then the political system scrambles to cope, either through, you know, reluctant reform or sometimes just outright force.
Okay, let's walk through the timeline they lay out, starting after Napoleon, say 1815 to 1832. What's the mood?
Grim, mostly. Britain won the war, but it's deep in debt. You've got masses of soldiers coming home with no jobs. And the ruling class seems pretty determined to protect its own interests.
Which brings us to the Corn Laws, right? 1815. infamous stuff.
Infamous is right. Basically, laws designed to keep bread prices artificially high to benefit the big aristocratic landowners. Imagine how that went down with hungry, unemployed people. It fueled massive anger, real radicalism.
And the state wasn't exactly sympathetic. Peterlee Massacre, 1819, that's a stark example.
It really is. Thousands gather peacefully in Manchester, asking for the vote, essentially, and the response. Cavalry charge, people killed. It sent a brutal message, challenged the system, and this is what happens.
So this pressure builds and builds, leading eventually to the Great Reform Act of 1832.
Yes, but Harvey and Matthew are clear. This wasn't some enlightened gift of democracy. It was a calculated, almost nervous concession.
What was the calculation?
To bring the wealthy middle classes into the system. Give them some power, make them stakeholders, essentially, to stop them siding with the more radical working classes below. It was about preventing a much bigger explosion.
A strategic move to keep control. And that sort of sets the pattern for the century, doesn't it? Reform as a way to avoid revolution.
Precisely. Bend so you don't break. But of course, giving the middle class the vote didn't solve the problems for the vast majority who still couldn't vote.
No, it arguably made some things worse, leading into the early Victorian conundrum period. Say 1832 to 1851.
Exactly. The social problems deepen. Take the Poor Law Amendment Act of 1834. This is driven by what the authors call Malthusian ideas.
Right, Malthus. The idea that helping the poor just encourages them to have more kids, making poverty worse. For listeners, what did that mean in practice?
It meant the workhouse. The system was deliberately designed to be harsh, degrading, worse than the worst paid job outside. The aim was to deter people from seeking help, force them into any work available. It caused incredible misery.
And that misery fuels resistance.
Absolutely. It directly feeds into the rise of Chartism. This was huge. The first mass working class political movement in history, millions demanding the right to vote for all men. It shows this growing political awareness among ordinary working people.
A demand for a voice, essentially. Not necessarily revolution, but representation.
Exactly. But alongside this, you get the utter tragedy of the Irish famine from 1845. Harvey and Matthew use this as a devastating example of rigid ideology in action.
The laissez-faire idea. Government shouldn't interfere.
Right. The belief that the market would sort it out. But sticking to that meant the government did far too little, far too late, while millions starved or were forced to emigrate. It's a chilling example of ideology trumping basic humanity.
But then there's a shift. Sir Robert Peel repeals the Corn Laws in 1846.
Yes, a massive political moment. Peel, a conservative prime minister, essentially chooses national stability, cheaper food, over the interests of his own party's landowners. It split the conservatives right down the middle.
But it worked. It calmed things down.
It did, largely. Cheaper bread took a lot of the steam out of Chartism, and it really paves the way for the next period, the sort of mid-Victorian high noon.
Okay, so 1851 to around 1875, this is the period of peak confidence.
Very much so. The Great Exhibition of 1851 housed in that spectacular Crystal Palace. It was basically Britain showing off to the world. Look at us. Look what we can make. Look how powerful we are. Pure industrial and imperial swagger.
A giant glass house full of confidence. You wonder if they knew it couldn't last. Politically, this is the era dominated by two giants, Gladstone and Disraeli.
Their rivalry really defined Victorian politics, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Gladstone, the serious, moralistic, liberal, obsessed with balancing the books, fiscal prudence.
And Disraeli, the flamboyant conservative, much more interested in empire, tradition, the monarchy, and this idea he called Tory democracy.
Ah, yes, Tory democracy. It sounds like a contradiction.
It does. How did he sell that? What was the appeal?
He was quite clever politically. Disraeli essentially appealed to the working classes, many of whom were getting the vote for the first time thanks to reforms he brought in. He said basically, okay, you might not be rich, but you're part of this grand, historic British Empire. Your identity is tied to the Queen, to national greatness, not just your wages.
So uniting the classes through patriotism and imperial pride.
Exactly. Using the theater of empire to create a sense of shared identity, often masking the inequalities at home. And of course, the empire itself was becoming more formally controlled.
Which brings us to the Indian Mutiny in 1857, a huge shock to the system.
A massive shock. It led directly to the British government taking formal control, establishing the Raj. India became the jewel in the crown. Absolutely central to British power and identity, but it also really hardened racial attitudes, both in India and back in Britain.
But this peak confidence, this high noon, it doesn't last forever.
No. By the 1870s, doubts start creeping in. We enter the phase Harvey and Matthew call late Victorian doubts, running up to 1914. A key driver was economic.
The Great Depression, though not like the 1930s one.
Right, not a sudden crash, but more of a long slowdown. Prices fell, profits were squeezed. And crucially, Britain started facing serious industrial competition.
From where?
Primarily from a newly unified Germany and the rapidly growing industrial might of the United States. Britain wasn't the only workshop anymore. Its lead was narrowing.
And that economic pressure cooker affects things domestically.
For sure. You see the rise of new unions organizing less skilled workers, leading to bigger, more confrontational strikes. And eventually, this feeds into the creation of the Labour Party in 1900, a distinct political voice for the working class.
Meanwhile, in Parliament, things get bogged down.
Very much so. Gladstone, in his later years, becomes almost consumed by the Irish question, the demand for Irish home rule. It dominated politics, split his own Liberal Party down the middle, and basically paralyzed Parliament for long stretches, showed the limits of the British state in managing internal national divisions.
And then the Boer War, right at the turn of the century, 1899-1902.
Yes, that was a real wake-up call. What was expected to be a quick colonial victory turned into a long, costly, difficult struggle against Afrikaner farmers in South Africa.
It exposed weaknesses.
Big time. Weaknesses in the army, yes, but also in the health and fitness of recruits, raising questions about national efficiency. The war revealed the strains of empire and dented that mid-century confidence. So by 1914, the picture the authors paint is of a Britain still outwardly powerful, but internally fragmented, facing huge challenges and really standing on the edge of a new, uncertain era.
That's quite a journey. So pulling back, what are the big overarching themes Harvey and Matthew want us to take away from this century of change?
Well, theme number one has to be that balancing act we mentioned, tradition versus innovation. The key to Britain avoiding revolution, they argue, was its institutional flexibility.
Meaning things like Parliament, the monarchy, they bent rather than broke.
Exactly. They adapted, their function changed to accommodate new pressures of the middle class, then parts of the working class, rather than rigidly sticking to the old ways like some European states tried to do. They co-opted change.
And the takeaway for us today may be that adaptable institutions are key to stability.
I think so. It shows that rigid systems are brittle systems. Flexibility, even reluctant flexibility, seems crucial for navigating massive social and economic shifts.
Okay, theme two.
The absolute integration of national and imperial identity. The empire wasn't just some over-there thing. It fundamentally shaped what it meant to be British.
It wasn't an optional extra.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It influenced finance, culture, social mobility. People could go out to the colonies and make a life. Harvey and Matthew argue Britain became its empire.
And the relevance now, it makes you think about how global connections, supply chains, foreign policy, they're not separate from domestic life or national identity today either, are they?
Spot on. It forces that connection.
Yeah.
Third theme, the rise and really the cultural dominance of the middle class.
More than just economic power.
Oh, yes. They imposed a whole new set of values. Evangelical morality, respectability, mm-hmm. the gospel of hard work, self-help. This became the dominant culture, shaping everything from social reforms to attitudes towards poverty.
It's a powerful example of how one group's values can come to define an entire society, for better or worse.
Definitely. And finally, theme four, that inherent tension between democracy at home and empire abroad.
Liberalism for us, autocracy for them.
Pretty much. Britain was slowly, gradually expanding rights and representation within its own borders, while simultaneously running a vast empire based on conquest and racial hierarchy. That fundamental contradiction runs right through the century. It was a source of power, but also, arguably, a deep moral failing.
Those are powerful themes. The book sounds like it's full of ideas that really make you stop and think. Are there any particular concepts or phrases that stand out, almost like memorable quotes?
Absolutely. Though maybe not direct quotes, but core ideas. One is definitely, the stability of Victorian Britain was not a natural state of quiet progress, but a hard-won, precarious equilibrium achieved over a chasm of social conflict.
That really flips the old narrative, doesn't it? Stability wasn't the default. It was the achievement. It had to be constantly managed through things like that 1832 Reform Act, or less pleasantly, through force, like at Peterloo.
Exactly. Peace is actively constructed, not just found. Another key idea is that the Industrial Revolution was less a sudden transformation than a gradual renegotiation of the relationship between work, family, and community.
So not an overnight switch, but people adapting their old ways to the new reality over time, bringing traditional values into the factories and cities.
Yes, it emphasizes the human adaptation, the continuity alongside the rupture. Change gets absorbed, wrestled with, over generations.
And the third one.
Simple but powerful. Empire was not something that happened to Britain. It was something that Britain became.
Right. That really drives home how integral it was. Not just a policy, but part of the national DNA, influencing everything from the economy to how people saw themselves.
So thinking about all this, how can we apply these lessons from 19th century Britain today? What are the real life applications?
Well, one obvious one is managing huge economic disruption. We're living through our own massive shift with AI and digital tech, right?
Absolutely.
And the 19th century is basically a case study. It shows that rapid technological change demands parallel political and social innovation. Things like public health, education reform, new regulations, safety nets, duh. Otherwise, the human cost becomes unbearable and you risk massive instability.
That's a great point. The tech changes, but the need for social adaptation remains constant. What else?
Well, thinking about politics.
Yeah.
The book offers real insights into populism and political strategy. Look at Disraeli's Tory Democracy.
Yes, appealing to the working class through empire and tradition.
Exactly. It's a classic playbook, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Using nationalism, tradition, maybe focusing on external issues or cultural identity to build a coalition that cuts across economic class lines. You can see echoes of that strategy in politics all over the world today.
It's a reminder that those techniques aren't new. They're historical strategies for managing democratic electorates and maybe a final application.
I'd say it's about institutional adaptability again. The British model, for all its flaws and reluctance, showed that gradual reform, that bending rather than breaking, can work. It suggests that successful democracies maybe need to be pragmatic, focus on workable solutions to real problems, rather than getting stuck in ideological purity, finding that messy middle ground.
Avoiding the all-or-nothing approach that often leads to disaster. It's about managing change, not perfectly controlling it.
Okay, so final thoughts. What's the one big takeaway for you from this deep dive into Harvey and Matthew's work?
For me, it's the reminder that modernity wasn't some clean, inevitable process. It was messy, chaotic, often brutal. The conflicts they describe, capital versus labor, the struggles over inequality, national identity, the role of the state. These are the very foundations of the world we live in now. The past isn't just prologue. Is actively shaping our present challenges.
Yeah, that really resonates. For me, what was perhaps most surprising or maybe most stark was the handling of Ireland, the sheer intractability of the Irish question.
The great failure of statesmanship, as you said.
It really highlights how difficult it is for even powerful, adaptable states to manage deep-seated internal divisions, especially national or ethnic ones. It shows the limits of that pragmatic, flexible model when faced with questions of fundamental identity and belonging. It's a sobering lesson about the challenges of multinational states.
A powerful reminder of the complexities involved.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.